also. So I've got to get back. Gretchen's sticking around for another week, but we'll be in and out over the next few months. So it's, again, it's good to be here with you today and bring love from our brethren in Delaware Valley. Everybody's doing pretty good. I think you've probably followed some of the exploits of Brother George. And Virginia, a special love to you, especially from Becky, Becky Rankin, and all the brethren there, too, that know you and always ask about you. So, Psalm 46 is an interesting psalm. It's really going to be kind of the background for a wider discussion around some of the current events that we're seeing going on, because I think it is certainly an interesting psalm, and what I call a phrase that we use a lot, you'll see in this, and you follow along in your scriptures, a familiar one about God being a very present help in time of need, but the broader psalm really pictures God in the midst of raging nations. And that's sort of where we want to look at what's been happening recently and come back to the psalm sort of at the end as a summary of what we see going on around us in the world today. The last few months have certainly been an interesting one around the world. In August, President Bush warned that a U.S. retreat from Iraq would embolden Iran to develop atomic weapons and trigger a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. And that came just hours after Ahmadinejad, who, of course, Iran's president, said that his country was ready to fill what he called the power vacuum that was being created by the United States' lack of influence or waning influence in the area, as he called it. And then Bush accused Tehran of destabilizing Iraq and Afghanistan, threatening the Middle East with an entire nuclear holocaust. At about the same time, if you followed some of the news coming out of Israel at that time, there was a wire came out of Jerusalem that said if Israel or the United States goes after Iran's nuclear program, the Iranians have long-range surface-to-surface missiles and said they would attack 600 targets in Israel. That came from Syria, was reported on July 14th. And of course, we know what happened in the last month. Israel did bomb some of Syria's, what they called were nuclear areas, which Syria very quietly didn't even protest the bombing, but said no, they were nothing but some of the storehouses. So it's been an interesting summer that we've seen take place in the Middle East. And it reminded me of Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural address when he said about the war, the Civil War, it was coming to the end of the Civil War, and he said neither party expected the war or the magnitude or duration which it has already attained. Each looked for easier triumph and a result less fundamental and astounding. And I think it really summarized. No one really pictured when we started this whole conflagration in Afghanistan that it would come out the way it has and shaped events the way it has. No one except the Lord, I think, and that's as we'll see as we look at this psalm. But events really are beyond the control sometimes of many people. But it's certainly true if you were a Shakespeare fan and you remember Macbeth and you had the witches and they sat around with, trouble around this cauldron that they had. Well, that's the way we could describe the Middle East today. It really is a cauldron boiling of trouble. It's got the worst political situation in the world, and it's got religious pathologies in that area that combined with the power of oil and gas reserves, terrorism, nuclear ambitions, what more could you want in terms of creating a drama there that no one could expect? So I think just like we saw what happened in Europe at the end of the 20th century, when we saw in the 19th or as the 20th century dawned, we saw Europe emerging as the powerhouse. I think we're seeing today the strategic arena really is shifting to the Middle East. So if this war ends in the Middle East, what happens then? Whether it's a premature or otherwise. I think no one really knows at this point. We've had a lot of changes that have taken place there. Look at Saddam Hussein. 20 years he was in power, driven out by the invasion of 2003, taken captive and killed. In Lebanon, we've had businessman and politician Rafik Hariri, who was assassinated in 2005. That ended the military occupation by Syria. After that, we had Islamic militants moving in. They were moving from Iraq to now recruit people in Lebanon. And Syria, all this time, was turning a blind eye kind of to what was happening as smuggling and smugglers were moving arms through their area into this whole area of Lebanon and Tripoli. In Lebanon itself, remember, had a lot of slayings take place of the leaders that were outspoken about what was going on in Syria. And Hariri's son, Saad, really stayed outside the country, still outside the country, because he continually worries about what Syria might do to them. And in Lebanon itself, he had the Prime Minister, Fuad Seniora, and he's the one, remember, came up with a plan in the UN that ended this 2006 conflict with Israel and the Palestinians in Lebanon. And that's actually created more problems for him than anyone would have ever thought, because it gave the Lebanese government authority over the territory through its own armed forces, and actually kept everyone else out. And so he's actually had to face some of the situation that's been taking place there. But he created a seven-point plan that's sort of come back to haunt him. If you look at Lebanon and all the trouble that's taken place there with the Palestinians, you know, there's been 400,000 Palestinians living in Lebanon for decades, really since the 67 war. And they can't be citizens in Lebanon. They have no rights as foreign workers. They can't travel outside the country. They can't own any property there. It's a crowded, hostile situation in about a dozen walled camps, and that's the situation they face. So the dilemma that Seniora has had in Lebanon is, you know, if I invade these camps, I violate the agreement I've made between us and some of the Arab countries. There's camps also in Syria and Jordan. What does that mean? One of the retired generals there, General Amin Hotate, said, "It's true that Palestinian camps are a ticking time bomb, but we should still not go after them because it will tear our country to pieces." And of course, if we looked at that small strip in Lebanon where we've seen the camps, all the extremists that reside there are from, of course, Islamic extremists. And it's the Sunni extremist group that split off from the Syrian-Palestinian faction. And they've got a lot of fighters ready to take up the cause in battle, especially against Israel. And they're welcoming all the Arab refugees into their camps to prepare that. And, of course, on next to Iraq and Jordan, we have Syria. And Bashar Assad of Syria has made known certainly that he's ready to take up the gauntlet after he took over from his father in 2000. Remember, his father ruled for almost 30 years. And he, on the other hand, we don't really know whether he's going to follow those same policies. But he denied any involvement in any of the problems that have happened there. He denied the involvement in the killing that happened in Lebanon. Denies any connection to the violence that has been going on. But he is, on the other hand, ready to reclaim Lebanon. There's nothing more he would like than to take Lebanon over again. And then, of course, our favorite character in the Middle East, the Groucho Marx of the Middle East. Who would that be? Ahmadinejad. Who else? Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Of course, he's a Holocaust denier. And so anybody in that case is either insane or I'm not sure what else you would call them. But he has made it known that he wants to really finish what Hitler started and wipe the Jewish people off the map. And he did sign a strategic accord with Syria that they would help each other to resist this pressure that has been put on them from other countries to not build up nuclear arms or nuclear capabilities. And that's what we've seen this whole summer. We've seen this play out where there's been a denial and a support, and it goes on. But if the U.S. is not there, as we said at the beginning, he does believe he'll advance to number one. Now, I don't know if any of you listened this summer when he was in at the U.N. and Ahmadinejad visited, and they had him at the Columbia School of Journalism. And if you listen to his speech there, it's really amazing. The guy has a great PR machine behind him, but I'm sure he went back and talked about how great he did, but he would not ever come to that statement of saying, yes, I accept Israel in the Middle East. He sort of hemmed and hawed around it. So he openly funds everybody that's terrorizing Israel right now, Hezbollah, Hamas, and yet at the same time tries to play the good guy. In Israel itself, there's been some interesting events take place because we know there's been kind of a power struggle even there. Benjamin Netanyahu, who was former prime minister, has said this summer, said, unless the United States stops Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons, America has only 2 to 5 years left. Now, that's an interesting statement, isn't it? Because of the situation in Iran. So you've got Iran and Syria as allies. They're united against the enemies of the two countries. And, of course, then they say that anyone in the Zionist regime has lost its ideology of existence. And Ahmadinejad believes that his sole purpose in serving as the head of Iran at this particular point was he was put on earth to usher in the Muslim Messiah, who is called Mahdi. And he wants to do that. He says the only way we do that is by creating some kind of a apocalyptic religious war. And so that's really what he's trying to do. He believes seriously that everyone will then welcome in Islam. Here was a statement that was appeared at the end of August in the New York Times. Hamas has sent hundreds of its fighters abroad for military training, most of them in Iran. The Israeli Army's deputy chief of staff says, and Israel has the names of more than 100 of them. Israel's watching as Hamas in control of Gaza is building an army there on the model of Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, said the deputy chief of staff, Major General Moshe Kaplinsky. He said Hamas was constructing positions and fortifications, building tunnels for fighting, and smuggling in explosives, anti-tank weapons, and more sophisticated rockets through the Egyptian desert. Hamas now has improved anti-tank missiles and mortars and possesses manufactured Katyusha rockets with a range of 10.6 miles, which they are keeping in reserve. Well, as if that weren't enough, we have some other people, some old enemies, really asserting power. And, of course, one of those big ones is Russia. Putin is trying to reassert Russia as a world power. And he delivered a keynote speech in Munich last February that he said, we're going to be more involved in the foreign policy that takes place throughout Europe and the Middle East. Now, you have a lot of confidence when you have all this wealth created by the oil. And that's exactly where Russia is today. And they're not afraid to use that power. For example, last April, the Estonian government moved a war memorial that was during the Soviet era, and they took the bodies that were buried under that war memorial and they moved the bodies. What did Russia do? Russia stopped its oil going into Estonia, and they actually launched an electronic blitzkrieg against all the websites in Estonia and shut that country down for several days. Now, Russia also, if you've seen lately, Putin is keen on being seen with Ahmadinejad to know that he's a friend, actually helped them to build that nuclear power plant that's been the big source of controversy. And it's no question that Russia supports Syria. They support the Palestinians. They have certainly Putin has visited Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Jordan. And we don't know this coming year, 2008, Putin has to stand down from elections. We don't know who will take his place, but we're starting to see some interesting developments there as he's appointed a few people that seem to indicate it will take the same avenue that he has taken. So that's the broad picture that we see sort of melding into the Middle East, a rather interesting one and a rather dynamic one. Now, if we turn to Revelation, the 16th chapter and the 16th verse, we have in that 16th verse, a very familiar statement. It's the prologue to volume 4. And it says, "And they gathered them together to the place in Hebrew, which is called Armageddon." And actually through the 20th verse, but I'm only going to mention the 16th verse. But it's at the time when the seventh angel is pouring out the bowl on the air, and the lightning and sounds and peals of thunder. We'll come back to this later as we get more into Psalm 46. But that's the theme that we see happening in this Revelation, the 16th chapter. And of course, Armageddon, if you've studied Volume 4, you know Armageddon is that picture that Brother Russell creates for us with all the dynamic forces, the political, the financial, the social, and what am I leaving out? Religious, financial, social, political, all those coming together at the end of time, at the end of this age, which then results in the Lord's victory over them and the inauguration, really, of his kingdom here on earth. And Brother Russell used this picture of Armageddon as the topic of the fourth volume. And if we look at those, we can classify certainly everything he wrote in that fourth volume along one of those five lines, which are religious, political, social, financial, and of course then bringing in Israel as the culminating point for this battle of Armageddon. So his picture in that Revelation 16, which he created as kind of that beginning of this battle of Armageddon, and also bringing in with Israel the battle of Ezekiel 38, that was what culminated, we said, in the seventh plague that is dumped on Armageddon that brings about the final culmination of those four systems that really dominate the world as we know it today. So if we turn to that Revelation 16, 17 to 21, that seventh plague, let's just look at a couple elements there. I'm going to read from the 17th verse on. "Then the seventh angel poured out his bowl upon the air, and a loud voice came out of the temple from the throne, saying, 'It is done.'" Verse 18, "There were flashes of lightning and sounds and peals of thunder. And there was a great earthquake, such as there had not been since man came to be upon the earth. So great an earthquake was it, and so mighty." Now those two our key scriptures as we look at this kind of battle of Armageddon and the culminating forces that take place. And remember, the focal point is the land of Israel, where in Ezekiel 38 we know Gog and Magog come together to battle against Israel at the time when God finally delivers them from that hand. And Revelation 16 mentions this gathering together and a great earthquake that takes place. I want to read just a couple excerpts from the Revelation notes of Brother Gene Burns regarding this seventh plague that's described here in Revelation 16. He says, "The plague contains the great earthquake, so mighty and great. Revelation 16 shows this earthquake from the standpoint of Babylon. Ezekiel 38 shows the same earthquake from the standpoint of Gog's invasion of Israel. We do not believe there are two great earthquakes, only one. In Revelation 16, we have one view of it, and in Ezekiel 38, we have another view of it. The only difference is the vantage point, whether one is looking at Babylon's fall or whether one is looking at Gog's defeat." So we're looking at either from the standpoint of the world as we know it that operates, or the world from Israel's viewpoint when they are being assaulted. So all these things are taking place at the same time. And let me read one excerpt from Volume 4, page 553. the Battle of Armageddon, that sort of summarizes the same sort of thing. While the trouble and distress of this day of the Lord will be first and specially upon Christendom, and eventually upon all nations, the final blast, we are informed by the prophet Ezekiel in 38:8-12, will be upon the people of Israel, gathered in Palestine. The prophet seems to indicate a much larger gathering of Israel to Palestine within this harvest period than has yet taken place. He represents them as gathered there out of the nations in great numbers and with considerable wealth, inhabiting the formerly desolate places, and all of them dwelling safely at the time when the rest of the world is in its wildest commotion. Of course, the world is in wild commotion, but Israel certainly is too. But the key phrase there, notice that Brother Russell saw at that point, says he represents them, Israel, the Jews, gathered there out of the nations in great numbers. And I think we've seen that. We've seen that gathering, the immigration to Israel that took place after World War II, especially coming out of Europe. But in the last 25 years, we've seen a great gathering of Jews to Israel from North America. And today, it's the highest it's been in 25 years. In 2006, we saw 3,200 residents of the U.S. and Canada become Israeli citizens. That was the most since 1983. 70% of those immigrants were under 35 years old. 40% of them were under 18. So if we look since 1948, nearly 125,000 North Americans have moved to Israel. And in 2006, Israel reached a milestone. After the Holocaust, only two main centers remained in Jewish life. One was in America, and the other was in Israel. In 1990, the Jewish population in America was 5.5 million. In 2000, it had shrunk to 5.2 million. Now, in the first quarter, January to March of 2006, Israel's Jewish population passed 5.6 million. Remember what I said, 5.2 million in the U.S. It's the first time since AD 135. That's a long time, brother. Since AD 135 that there were more Jews in Israel than in any other country. So, did we see them gather there in great numbers? Yes. Have we seen that continue and even more dominant? Yes. We knew there had not been a great migration from the Western Hemisphere of Israel, but it's happened in the last 25 years. And in this decade, the decade of the 2000s, it's happened even more. Now, of course, in opposition with Israel is the Islamic civilization. It's an interesting group because the birth rates of the Islamic civilization are more than double that of the European average. At some point in the future, the population of Yemen, for example, will exceed Russia's. The traditional mainstream Islam, of course, accepts and promotes violence, and the so-called Muslim majority that's out there really has said almost nothing. And if we looked at today where we have the greatest population gatherings of Muslim, it's, of course, in Africa, where we have almost 50% of the population that's Muslim. Asia, almost about 25%. Europe is fairly small at 5%. And North America is even smaller at only around 2%. But it is interesting that the developing parts of the world, the third world of countries that are still in development, really are highly Muslim. So as those areas of the world develop, I think that's when you see even more prevalence come from the Muslim population. And of course, I think that Muslim population and the terrorism of the Muslim impacts all four elements that are involved in this Battle of Armageddon that we've had described here in Revelation 16 and Ezekiel 38. And it impacts Israel, as we're seeing today. Islam is the primary opponent, we could say, of Babylon, which is Christendom, and democracy. I mean, they're willing to kill in the name of Allah, not a man or a nation. They have access to weapons and technology that Hitler never had. Islam is today on the warpath in 50 different nations around the world. And the cost, as we know, of this war on terrorism, when you're fighting it all over the world, is certainly significant. We're fighting now this terrorism that is based on Islamic rule in Afghanistan, Iraq, Lebanon wants us to provide funds. And at the same time, we have our own domestic cost of population going down. The common goal, of course, of every one of these terrorist organizations that exist, we can name many of them. I think here a couple years ago, we were here for New Year's, I showed you that slide that showed the known terrorist organization with the common goal, all of them being the destruction of Israel. Remember that that Revelation 16 chapter said that God would gather them together at that place called Armageddon. So how are those nations gathered? Are they physically gathered? I think if we look at some of the things mentioned in Volume 4 specifically, some observations. Chapter 8, the cries of the reapers, which was right before World War I. There were three things, three key points that Brother Russell made there, I think, that are probably as pertinent today as they were then. And tell me if you think I'm describing 1912, 1913, or I'm describing 2007, 2008. Number one, the results of the move to globalism produced an undesirable effect. The global sourcing of things, the declining profitability, and the bankruptcies of nations. Second, free trade put pressure on the currencies. Number three, the people of the world were ripe for a revolution. Most of them didn't want economic isolationism, but they saw this continual move to globalism as a lack of improvement in their living conditions despite the progress that they made. Well, that was pre-World War I. I think we see it today. What we've seen happen is the inequality that gets created from globalization is actually sort of repeating itself in a way. We've had a lot of international competition that forces local firms to add skilled workers, and they can't. They have to handle the new technology and get rid of those that can't. And foreign firms bring new technology to the developing nations, places like Africa or India or China, and boost demand for skilled workers by paying more than domestic firms. And those prices and rises go up. And if we see what's happened in places like Latin America that have been globalized since 1989 in the free trade agreement that we had with Canada and Mexico, we see that countries like Mexico, Colombia, and Peru have actually had a negative average income change. Almost in Mexico, it's been 20%. In Peru, almost 40% decline in real income from before to after economic liberalization. Now, China, of course, has been a boom so far. China, we had back in 1981, we had 600 million people. 60% of the population was living on less than a dollar a day. Have you ever tried to live on less than a dollar a day? I had a friend who said, Len, we can go to Europe and we'll live on $5 a day. That was back in the 70s. I'm not sure you could do that today. But that's what it was in China. Today, only 10% of the population is living on less than a dollar a day. So we've had a great economic boom in China, still going on, and we'll see what happens once they reach that stature where we've seen it happen in Mexico or where we've seen it happen in South America. Now, in the foreword, the 1916 foreword to Volume 4, Brother Russell concluded a whole statement on the debts of warring nations, but he said, just the last statement I want to read, the last sentence, he said, evidently the war will not stop from lack of men to shoot and be shot, but either from lack of food or from financial weakness. That it will be the latter is the author's opinion. And I think that's right. If we look at before World War I, it was a time of capitalism. The government was really allowing it pretty much to move around the world. England was the only imperial power. It was the only country willing to fight anywhere in the world. And you had the gold standard versus floating currencies today. And everything in that regime was sort of destroyed in World War I. When World War II was over, almost no movement took place of capital between countries. So what we're seeing today is kind of this reemergence of what was taking place before World War I. And then that's when we had all these totalitarian ideologies like Islam, like what we had with communism, all those coming into being at that point. Of course, we've seen recently, I guess what you could call a money meltdown in many places. If you've tried to travel to Europe recently, you know the rise in the euro, and even in America, the pound sterling really has been pretty significant. In fact, it's the first time I can remember that the Canadian dollar is actually higher than the U.S. dollar. You can't get a one-for-one exchange. So, but at the same time, we've seen, even though we had this rise around the world, one of the key factors we've seen is that all of the world's currencies have been depreciating relative to stable benchmarks, like gold. Since 2001, we've seen, for example, the euro has declined, has gone from 38% to nearly 60%. The U.S. dollar 60% decline, euro has declined 38% against the price of gold. So what we've seen, just like in World War II, we had the financial world changing. We saw rapidly rising prices. We saw inflation being accepted as normal. Throughout the 19th century, it almost didn't exist. It's only since the war, World War I, World War II, that we've seen this sort of rise in standard of living, but the rise in the inflation rate has really deprecated the currencies around the world. If you went back to the 1820s up to 1920, you actually saw the consumer price index inflation was zero. It really didn't move up until 1920. And then today, inflation is accepted as a norm. I can show you, I'm just going to turn this around. You can see this is the consumer price index, as you can see, from 1970 through just 2000 or 2002. And you can see that just kind of general incline. It's sort of accepted that just the cost of living continues to go up, but it wasn't always that way. And the United Kingdom, same thing that's happened there. Why has that happened? Why suddenly did it take place after World War II? When the nations got into acute fiscal stress, particularly during times when you have war, all-out war, where it just continues, governments really are unwilling to slow down or maybe unable to maintain kind of a stable currency because they have to fund both the debt of the war and they have to fund the government spending programs. Now, you don't have anything like we had 1917, 18, or 1941 to 45. So why do we have this kind of continual rise? Well, I think it's financial technology. If we look at the wide scale we have that very few people understand, and it's so global in nature, so beyond the reach of any one set of regulators, that it's just accepted that we incur this risk. But you see what's happened recently when we had something like the subprime mortgage market. Your mortgage was financed in Germany. And who knew that? No one. But that's where those loans were sold. So I think it's just sort of accepted that if we spread the risk around the world, there's less worry about everything. But you know what happens is when you get in that situation, it means that the problems of one nation become the problems of another nation. Since 1971, there's no government that's been made an attempt to fix any more their currency to the value of gold. And so what happens is you get this unpredictability, you get this chronic sort of planet-wide in scope of sort of many disasters that can happen. And it leaves the financial markets, remember the reason I'm focusing on this, because remember that was where Brother Russell sort of thought he would see things collapse at the end, would be financially driven. And I think we really don't know where that's going. And the massive increase we've seen in kind of this public sector share of the economy after World War II. We created all the programs like Social Security. The government took on new debt to finance programs. And it wasn't any of that was war-related debts. It's long-range government spending and commitments such as pension funds, such as Social Security. If I were to ask you, what would you guess today, your household, what's the cost for your household of the unfunded? In other words, there's no money currently, it's to be funded in the future, or hopefully have money there, that promises that are made by the combination of the federal, state, and local government. Just your share of those unfunded promises for each household. What number would you guess? Any guesses? I'd wager you'd guess too low. It's about $516,000 per household. That's the cost of our unfunded liabilities today as we look forward. So despite what Al Gore calls the inconvenient truth, the real inconvenient truth is not global warming. It's that today we find governments around the world reducing public debt without abrogating it. But they use inflation and the allowance of the cost of living to rise as a way for them to sort of postpone the inevitable insolvency that I think someday has to catch up with you. As long as we have all the currencies depreciating against gold, I think it's a sign of worldwide inflation. And it's like, you remember the old Chinese torture that says death by a thousand cuts? I think that's exactly what you see going on in the world today, and we have these many crises going on. So that's sort of the background that if you think about how we cast Volume 4 in this Battle of Armageddon shaping up, and you say, are you ever going to get to Psalm 46? Yes. But it's important background because that's really what we have pictured in Psalm 46, which I'll spend the last 10 minutes or so talking about. God in the midst of this raging nation. And the reason I pick out Psalm 46 in a very early reprint article, reprint 509, and it's a three-page reprint article, 509 to 512, Brother Russell says, Psalm 46 seems to give a complete picture of the seventh plague of Revelation. And I think that's the connection with this psalm and what we see in Revelation. There's three purposes, I think, that are described in Psalm 46. I'm not going to go into the detail of each verse, but it sort of summarizes you look at this. But these are the three things, I think, that are mentioned as a purpose. Psalm 46 is describing this total destruction. Number one, the complete judgment upon the elements of Babylon. Number two, that God will exalt his name through Israel regathered. And number three, God will establish a true peace on earth. And so as we look at Psalm 46, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Many people stop at that point. It's one of the most popular verses in Scripture. But it's as we go on, we see what that means and who it's really dedicated to. Verse 2 says, therefore will not we fear, though the earth and society be removed, and though the mountains or kingdoms be carried into the midst of the sea, overthrown by the ungovernable masses, as we find in commenting on this, though the waters thereof roar and be troubled, that picturing the great commotion, though the mountains shake with the swelling thereof, Selah. Verse 4, there is a river, the streams whereof shall make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacles of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God shall help her, and that right early. Now that verse 5, if we look at, I want to read this to you from the New American Standard, and also the Holman Christian Bible has this the same way. God is within her. She will not be toppled. God will help her when the morning dawns. Now that's an interesting statement. Verse 6, the heathen raged, the kingdoms were moved, he uttered his voice, the earth melted. verse 7, the Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Notice the repetition of that, Selah. Verse 8, come, behold the works of the Lord, what desolations he hath made in the earth. He maketh wars to cease unto the ends of the earth. He breaketh the bow and cutteth the spear in sunder. He burneth the chariot in fire. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the heathen. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Now, from reprint 5059, Brother also talks about that verse 1 and 2. He says, this text pictures the great storm of trouble, which in the close of this age will suddenly burst upon the whole world of mankind, and in which Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, like a great millstone, will be cast into the sea. Our text pictures that coming time of trouble as a great storm which will entirely remove or change the earth or the present construction of society and carry the mountains, the kingdoms of this present time into the sea of anarchy. Notice the next words he says, God's people will to some extent be associated with these troubles, but they are not to fear. They are to realize that God is at the helm. Although sharing with others in the great disaster, the troubles will not invade their hearts. Remember in verse 5, I read that to you, where it said that he would deliver them when the morning dawns. Now that's an interesting phrase, because when do we find the church delivered? The church is actually delivered in the dawn of the millennial age. And so we see them standing by. And even to some extent, we find the repetition occurring with the people of Israel. If that verse 5 represents the church, which I think Brother Russell says it does, and I think that's a good statement, we're here in the midst of all the troubles taking place, but we should not fear, because we will be delivered in the midst of that trouble as the morning dawns. And so although we get associated with it in the sense that we're there when some of it happens, the trouble should not invade our heart. That psalm promises that God will exalt his name in the middle of all the trouble that's going on. Ezekiel 36:23, he says, I will vindicate the holiness of my great name, which has been profaned among the nations, which you have profaned in their midst. Then the nations will know that I am the Lord, declares the Lord God, when I prove myself holy among you in their sight. Notice again, God is saying, and he's talking here to specifically around the nation of Israel, that God would use that nation to show his great name. Reprint 53:64, he says, after the trouble, the Lord will command the nations to be still and recognize him as God. And reprint 7:63 says, then the preparatory work will be accomplished and the proper work of the new kingdom may begin. Isaiah 54:9-10, I think, talks about Israel standing during this same time of trouble that we have here. Notice the very similar language we'll see to what has occurred in Psalm 46. Isaiah 54:9-10. For this is like the days of Noah to me. That's a familiar scripture associated with the church, even, isn't it, in the New Testament. When I swore that the waters of Noah would not flood the earth again, so I have sworn that I will not be angry with you, nor will I rebuke you. Now here he's talking to Israel. For the mountains may be removed and the hills may shake. Very similar language to what we saw that in Psalm 46. But my loving kindness will not be removed from you, and my covenant of peace will not be shaken, says the Lord who has compassion on you. Well, as we look at all these things, I realize it's been kind of a whirlwind tour with the background around Revelation 16, that Battle of Armageddon, Psalm 46 picturing this as it encompasses the complete plague, incorporating Ezekiel 38, that battle that Israel faces when Gog descends on her. All those things coming together so that God can vindicate his name in the midst of this, convict the raging nations and bring peace, true peace on the earth. Volume 4, page 521, Brother Russell talks about what is the proper attitude for God's people, knowing that we are here for some of this trouble, as he describes it, that takes place. What is the proper attitude? You know, this is the first generation on earth that's really capable of destroying the whole earth. We haven't seen that before. You know, World War I, World War II, it was a pretty localized war. They could have destroyed Europe, but not really destroyed the whole world. But now we've got, as we talked about earlier, Muslim terrorists arming themselves with nuclear weapons that could annihilate the earth. For them, it's the glory of heaven with 40 Vestal virgins. So an understanding is necessary for us as people look at this world today and try to figure out what in the world is happening. And if there is a God, why would he let this happen? The second thing is we need to exercise our character to stand apart from the trouble, not to participate in the criticism that goes on of the governments and everything else. We realize what's going on, but to exercise our character to stand apart and represent a point of view that represents Jesus and God's viewpoint, not the viewpoint of general society. And fourth, our own personal integrity. In a time when people are upset, convicted, willing to do anything, for us to maintain personal integrity as we deal with those around us is a very important part of what we must maintain. And finally, let's be alert to the problems, to the dignity of the individuals that we see. It's a difficult time for many. And they see not much future in a world torn apart by ideologies, by religions, by societies that hate each other. We need to be that calming influence and be alert to those problems and dignity of those individuals. Brethren, that psalm promises that God will establish true peace on earth. Psalm 46:9 says, "He maketh wars to cease unto the end of the earth. He breaketh the bow and cutteth the spear in sunder. He burneth the chariot in the fire." In reprint 31:14, Brother Russell comments on this saying, "Out of the wild commotion of that stormy sea, God will bring order and peace." Let's never lose sight of that as we look at and survey these things going on all around us, and be the calming influence we need to be and represent the standard of our Lord. And remember that we're all in this together. We all expect to be delivered a great day to be with our Lord and helping to bring about this peace. It's a precious promise that we have. And so even as we look at these things that are not so pleasant to look at, we do remember that God promises to have something much better for man in the future, and we can be part of it. Let us rejoice and be glad in that. Amen.
Well, thank you very much, Brother Len. I think we can definitely use to ponder upon what's going on in the earth and see at what time we are and what we are to do, how we are to stand at this time. And this psalm is definitely a very